Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Monday, May 10th. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. My name is Magnus Tiefeld. I'm your host for this hour. We've got a great show for you today. We're going to start off with the coronavirus world update from the BBC, news from around the world and what's happening with COVID-19. After that, we have an interview with SFU Professor Ahmad El-Rawi, talking about disinformation. He's one of the team members of the Disinformation Project, both studying disinformation on the internet and other venues, and also how to combat it. And we have a conversation with him. On Front Burner, they're taking a look at what we can expect of this summer. Good news or bad news? It always seems so unpredictable, so it'd be good to get some information on what we can really expect for summer 2021. All that and more coming up on Speak Up today.
This is the Coronavirus Global Update on Monday, the 10th of May. I'm Gareth Barlow. Saudi Arabia gives the green light for this year's Hajj pilgrimage. Germany lifts priority limits for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And the head of the IOC cancels his trip to Japan in advance of the Olympics. The authorities in Saudi Arabia say some foreign citizens will be allowed to perform the annual Hajj pilgrimage this year. Only 10,000 Saudi nationals were permitted to attend in 2020 because of the pandemic. Yusuf Taha reports.
It is every Muslim's lifelong dream to perform Hajj, which is the fifth pillar of Islam. So when the coronavirus hit last year and the Saudi authorities decided to allow only 10,000 domestic pilgrims, about 3 million would-be pilgrims were disappointed. Saudi Arabia now says the foreign worshippers will be welcomed this July. The Ministry of Hajj said the details and conditions would be made public at a later date. The state news agency said the health authorities continue to assess the COVID-19 situation.
The German government has lifted the priority limits for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. The German Health Minister Jens Spahn said the jabs would no longer be restricted to people over the age of 60. The restriction had been imposed over rare thrombosis risks. Mr. Spahn said younger people could choose to get vaccinated with Johnson & Johnson after consultation with their doctors. Last week, Germany also lifted prioritisation for AstraZeneca vaccines, allowing all adults to receive a shot after checking with their doctors. Experts appointed by the government of Norway have recommended that coronavirus vaccines made by AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson be excluded from the country's immunisation programme. However, the commission said people should be allowed to receive either of the two jabs if they choose to have them. Last month, Norwegian health officials advised that AstraZeneca vaccine should be dropped completely because of fears that it could cause blood clots in very rare cases. However, the government decided to seek further expert advice on the health risks associated with the two vaccines. Cyprus is reopening its borders to tourists from 65 countries. The move is an attempt to revive the crucial tourism sector, which has been badly hit by the coronavirus pandemic. Here's our Europe regional editor, Mike Sanders.
Cyprus has a population of about 1.2 million, and so far there have been nearly 70,000 cases of coronavirus on the island and 336 deaths. So it clearly has been a problem, and they're trying to address that with rapid testing. They have a series of 63 rapid testing sites set up around the country, and they say that even that is not enough. So they're trying to get some more going because there was pretty severe overcrowding over the weekend at seven of these sites. But they say they managed to carry out more than 100,000 tests on Sunday alone, so they're certainly doing what they can.
The Czech Republic has recorded the lowest number of coronavirus infections since the end of last summer. On Sunday, 381 new positive tests were registered. From today, all remaining small retailers can reopen, as well as most services. Some cultural facilities will also be allowed to open, though with restrictions on numbers. Masks are no longer mandatory outdoors in built-up areas, as long as a 2-metre distance from others can be maintained. A planned trip to Japan by the head of the International Olympic Committee to review preparations for this summer's games has been postponed because of the coronavirus. Thomas Bach had been due to travel next week to take part in a torch relay event and meet the Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga. It's now thought the visit will take place in June. The postponement underscores the problems facing the Olympics as Japan struggles to contain rising infections. China is to set up a line of separation on the summit of Mount Everest to prevent the mingling of climbers from Nepal with those from the Tibetan side due to concerns over COVID-19. Ramana Dashgupta reports.
The precautionary measure was reported by Chinese state media following a sharp increase in coronavirus cases in Nepal. But critics have questioned how the line would be enforced as the summit of Everest is about the size of a dining table. A small team of Tibetan climbing guides will ascend the mountain to set up the divide, but it's unclear whether they will stay to enforce the separation in the world's highest spot. Nepal has issued around 400 permits for climbers this season. China has not allowed any foreign climbers from the Tibetan side since the start of the pandemic last year.
The Brazilian president, Jair Bolsonaro, has gone on a motorbike ride with hundreds of his supporters in an act called to assert the right to come and go. He met the bikers outside his official residence in Brasilia and led the ride through the wide streets of the capital without addressing the crowd. Mr. Bolsonaro has been critical of lockdowns and social distancing measures introduced by state governors and mayors. And that was the coronavirus global update.
Thanks to the BBC for that. Let's take a quick look at today's weather. Not a bad week coming up. Today is going to be sunny with cloudy periods, highs to 14, 18 inland, cloudy overnight. Tomorrow is looking terrific with highs up to 17, sunny. But the clouds come in the evening and overnight, and Wednesday is going to be cloudy. But things get better on Thursday and looking good pretty much through the weekend, although it looks like some rain is predicted for Sunday. So that's your weather for this week here in Vancouver. Coming up next, we have an interview with SFU professor Ahmed Al-Rawi. He's part of the Disinformation Project, and he's going to be talking to me about disinformation in the modern era and in the era of COVID-19. Joining me today is SFU professor of communication, Ahmed Al-Rawi. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So you've been studying the sort of problem of disinformation for a while, not just since COVID started, but you've been at it for a while. Maybe we can start by, if you can define, what is disinformation?
Disinformation is the intentional attempt to spread false information to the public. The motivation behind spreading such information could be varied, depending, of course, on one's interests or background. We do have in the literature a discussion about the use of trolls or bots in spreading disinformation. And this often happens by state-run actors or other actors who are affiliated with nation states.
Right. So this has really become a particular problem with sort of the advent and popularity of social media. I mean, disinformation has always been around, but it seems to be much more of a problem these days.
For sure. It exacerbated the problem of having bad information available to the public. And the problem, of course, is that it's just one click away from you. Unlike before, where probably disinformation could be found in a newspaper and not all people could have access to that kind of newspaper or on TV. So today it's just one click away from you and it's always there. You can go back to it, unlike, again, traditional media.
Mm-hmm. So what is it particularly about social media that makes it so effective at spreading this? And what are the sort of techniques that people doing this are using?
That's an excellent question. So social media, or what they call Web 2.0, is based on the concept or the premise that there is an exchange of information among people. Unlike before with Web 1.0, where there is mostly one flow or one directional flow of information. You just have websites and people browse them and view them. But today with Web 2.0, there is a lot of interaction. And this kind of networked nature of the of social media allows further dissemination of bad information, as well as, of course, good information. So we talk about the power of share, the power of like. And on Facebook, you have, for example, the emojified reactions to different posts. All of this would increase the likelihood that certain types of information will be sent to you. And of course, above that, we have the algorithms that social media sites use in order to cater information based on your previous browsing activities. So you might be targeted with, I mean, that's the algorithm deciding on what information to be sent to you. So you might be targeted with information that could be very problematic. So this is the nature of social media. And of course, like billions of people are on different social media sites, which also increases the likelihood of information, bad information being spread to many other people. So this is related to the popularity of social media sites. And of course, mobile social media as well included. I'm sorry, Magnus, the second part of the question was...
What are the techniques that people engaging in this activity are using?
Yeah, so I go back to the first point I made about the different motivations behind using bad information. So, as I said, there are different actors. So let's take, for example, state-run trolls. Mm-hmm. They... first of all, use the technique of astroturfing. Astroturfing is a term borrowed from false grass that's usually used in stadiums. Mm-hmm. But it's applied in marketing, political marketing in particular more recently, because certain front groups or think tanks try to send messages that would be supportive of or favorable towards certain corporations or political parties without disclosing the real supporters of certain types of information. We saw these techniques mostly used during the 2016 U.S. election by the Russian as well as the Iranian state-run trolls. Mm-hmm. So they pretended to be far-right community groups or supporters of Black Lives Matter in order to send some divisive messages to the American public. Messages that might mobilize people, agitate them. So there is even a term called edutainment, which is a combination of two words, agitation as well as entertainment. So they try to send them information that could be pleasing to some, but at the same time, it might agitate them, make them angry. And this anger might motivate them to do something, like go on a rally or a protest and so on. So astroturfing is one of these techniques. Another type of technique often used by state-run actors is... playing on emotions, is the use of emotions. So it might be linked a bit with the concept of edutainment. But today when we talk about social media, it's all about how you feel about things. Mm-hmm. So if they know exactly what triggers people, they will be better able to influence them. And that's the second technique, I would say, major technique that they try to use. And mostly negative types of emotions. Because... you know, it's good to send positive, let's say, energy or positive types of information to people, but it might not mobilize them as much as negative emotions. So they mostly work on anger, sadness, bitterness, and all of these negative feelings could help them achieve their strategic goals. Again, most of these strategic goals will be sowing division in a certain society. Yeah. Now, others have commercial motives. So the technique is to sell products or, you know, using what they call clickbaits, which means trying to send you something so appealing that you cannot resist but clicking on a link. So these are clickbaits that would generate revenues for the websites owned, run, managed by those people. So these are mostly, you know, done for financial reasons or for, you know, selling certain services or goods. The third technique used is probably just humor, just wasting people's time and making them feel more confused. And it's just for fun, used for fun. Yes, Magnus.
So how does the way social media platforms work and the way they're structured and their algorithms play into how these techniques become effective?
Those people, I mean, the bad actors I'm referring to, have actually reached a stage of maturity that they started gaming the system. They know the system very well and started abusing it, exploiting the vulnerabilities of social media platforms. So any kind of loophole that is identified could be exploited and used to serve their own purposes. So I can give you an example on state-run trolls from the Middle East. Twitter, for example, allows people to flag other users and report them. But this feature has been exploited by state-run trolls from Saudi Arabia to silence activists, human rights defenders and activists by reporting them to Twitter, claiming that they are either terrorists or affiliated with terrorists. So notice how that feature, which is supposed to be used for good purposes, has been weaponized and exploited by those bad actors.
How do we counter these kinds of techniques, and who is responsible for doing that?
That's a great question. I think we are all in this together. We all share a responsibility in terms of countering the types of bad information we see in front of us. And I always mention this, that if you see something wrong spreading on social media, try to resist sharing it. Even if you find it to be amusing or so silly that it has to be shared, please don't, because you will be involved in further spreading this kind of bad information to other people. So we do share our responsibility in limiting bad information. But of course, this comes with literacy, with knowledge. We need to be equipped with knowledge. So there is a theory, and that's what the booklet was about, you know, information inoculation, just like vaccination. Mm-hmm. You know, you get vaccinated. We call this pre-debunking, which means in order to be protected from bad information, you need to be exposed to it, trained on how to deal with it, so that when it comes, you will be immune from its impact. Again, similar to vaccination. We need to have, in other words, some training in order to be able to be better protected from that bad information.
This is something that really would need to start in schools.
So very early on.
You're part of a group that created a handbook called the COVID-19 Vaccination Handbook around Disinformation. How is your research and what you've come to understand about how disinformation campaigns work and how they're affecting society? How have you put that into action in that book?
In that handbook, we try to understand how people who don't believe in vaccination or masking or social distancing think. We wanted to understand how to talk to them. So it was like an intellectual exercise, putting ourselves in their shoes and trying to think in the same way. And accordingly, we will trying to design or come up with ideas, strategies to talk to them. And that was not easy because you needed more information, background knowledge about how they came out to think in this way. For example, many people don't believe in vaccination long before COVID-19. So some of the discussion was related to the alleged connection between vaccination and autism. And if you go back in time, it goes back to, you can trace it back to the Wakefield article that was published in the Lancet Journal. And afterwards it got redacted. And from there, some of the anti-vaxxers started saying, oh, science is being censored. So you need to understand where they come from and how they think in order to be able to better address their concerns, because they are still part of our society, and ignoring them or overlooking their concerns will not help. You need to find very effective ways of talking to those people, because whether we like it or not, they still pose a public health risk, or could pose a public health concern for us. If they are, of course, transmitting the disease. So we need to talk to them so that we will all be better protected.
So what are the ways we would try and talk to them? Because I think many of us have probably had conversations where you try and explain to someone about vaccines, and you point to studies or you point to this, and they just come back with some other angle or tiny bit of information that to them disinvalidates what you say. So how do we talk to people and get around that?
You need to see and understand their claims, mm-hmm. study them carefully, and also think and reflect well about counterclaims. Mm-hmm. So this requires some kind of preparation in advance, of course. You need to be, as I said, inoculated. You need to be ready for some kind of discussion. Mm-hmm. So talking about autism, there is no scientific proof on that. Actually, it's been, it's a hoax. It's been debunked. And the same applies to the other issues surrounding vaccination. So in other words, you need to understand the mental framework of those people and where they come from. So this is important in order to be better equipped in addressing their concerns. Some of their concerns, by the way, could be valid. Like, again, they would say, there is no science behind it. They are trying, notice how, I mentioned valid because they are trying to use the word science. And that's where your role as an expert or a debater comes, where you can bring in the science so that you show them that it's based on consensus, not based on what you think or feel is right or wrong. And that's how the society goes on, correct?
So you mentioned a mental framework that a lot of people who engage in a lot of the disinformation as consumers. What is that framework, and what are the vulnerabilities that you've identified that sort of lead people to be drawn in by it?
Can you please explain the consumer part?
There are sort of two part. There are the people who create these campaigns and promote this information, and then there are the people who are their targets, who are the people they're hoping to take in with it. Because you mentioned a bit of a framework of how people who do tend to fall into the trap of disinformation.
For the anti-vaxxers, you are specifically talking about the anti-vaxxers, correct?
Well, that's a great example that we can use.
Okay, we can talk about them. So for the anti-vaxxers, they regard themselves as a social movement. Mm-hmm. And we have, on the one hand, so-called leaders, central figures, no matter what you want to call them. And we have also followers. When it comes to their intended targets, they could be the general public as a whole. Anyone who is still probably trying to understand the situation, not sure what their position is yet. So I believe that they could be a very good target for the anti-vaccine vaccination community. The leaders or central figures already have very strongly held views, and these views are a bit hard to change because this has come with time. But for the followers, you can probably talk to them. You can probably persuade them or sway their views in a way. What's the core of their own discussion? It's mistrust in science. That's the main core, which means that they have found certain gaps or concerns or issues that could be problematic for them. And that's where you can come and talk to them. Now, some say, well, they are critical. Yeah. And being critical is a good thing. We always encourage critical thinking. Our society progresses because of critical thinking. Even if the authorities don't like it, but critical thinking is good. However, there are limits to critical thinking. Critical thinking cannot be applied to everything because we still need to rely on something. There must be some basis, like scientific consensus. If you believe the Earth is flat just because you are critical, then you are ending up being a bit absurd in my mind. Because there is a lot of evidence that the Earth is not flat. There is consensus on that. And so on. Well, the same applies to vaccination. There is a lot of consensus, scientific consensus. And this comes with peer-reviewed work in the scientific community in order to reach very solid conclusions about certain things. And that's how, again, we progress as a civilization, as a society. So being critical is good, but to a certain extent. But again, I mean, if you look at their main concern, it's mistrust in science and or scientists. So you need to walk through the steps with them, show them that what they are afraid of or concerned about could be easily addressed. There are many things, you know, and in today's world, we also have a lot of so-called scientists, a lot of people who pretend to be scientists, but they are not, and making very absurd claims or sometimes unscientific claims. So that's also the danger of the media ecosystem that we have today. Anyone is an expert today.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I've noticed in trying to research, you know, some claims or some reporting is you'll often see that someone will do an article on the web or whatever, making some sort of claim, whether it's, you know, anti-vax or in a political framework, you know, and they cite some other source and you go look at that source, and they cite some other source. And often it leads almost in a circle where it comes back to the beginning, or it's to a, you know, a set of allied groups and interests and websites that all seem to be talking to and about each other to create this sort of platform of pseudo authority for their claims. I'm not sure there's a question there, but it definitely seems to be part of the problem because there's a lot of certainly, I mean, it's not just the disinformation you need to sort through. It's the web of, you know, are these legitimate or not legitimate entities that are supposedly backing up? And I guess that brings us back to this idea of astroturfing and others, where there's a whole parallel system of information referral that seems to support a lot of this disinformation.
That's a very good point. And that's exactly what is happening today. So what you described is a tightly knit network within the larger internet sphere. So these members of the network exchange information amongst themselves. The problem is that sometimes some of these types of information would go outside the network, would be leaked, would be spread outside that tightly knit network. And that's where the danger is. And Canada is not also immune from this. So sometimes certain Canadian websites are actually involved in spreading disinformation in order to back or support the false claim around the world. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, COVID-19 is a bioweapon, is a biological weapon designed by the United States Army and was used intentionally in China in order to create chaos. And that was a type of information that is seen circulating among certain bad actors, whether by the Chinese state-run trolls or by the Russian state-run trolls. again, trying to, you know, support their views and attack their opponents in this way, and using their tightly knit community members to spread this kind of information among themselves.
The handbook around COVID-19 vaccine is sort of focused on a particular set of issues related to disinformation. But do you see the sort of lessons you're learning creating that book and the sort of applications to this specific problem as something perhaps a template or the start of a template that can be applied more broadly?
I guess it's an important step in the process of making use of our theoretical knowledge and benefiting people's lives. Now, for me, the ultimate objective will be designing workshops, delivering them to the general public, by which we can train them or inoculate them against bad information. Mm-hmm. So some of the things we learned in the process is how to do this in more practical ways and how to use real case examples. So it could be part of this whole process, like one of the important steps. And it's in our view, this is an ongoing issue. I don't think disinformation will just disappear with the disappearance of COVID-19. It will continue. So we will continuously need to have a certain kind of training in order to be protected from this type of bad information.
Is there an aspect of almost a competition almost of sorts between, or an arms race, that's the term I'm looking for, between the people creating and exploiting these techniques and people like yourself who are researching it and trying to find ways to counter it? Is that something you're seeing in the research you've been doing over time? Or is it something we can maybe at one point figure out and get a handle on just by eventually understanding how it works and employing countermeasures?
For state-run trolls and state-run actors who are involved in spreading disinformation, they do their best to do so in a stealthy manner using astroturfing techniques. And it's just by chance that we bump up or find ways to expose them. It's just by chance. I can give you one example, one simple example. I was doing a study about the social media discussion on the 2017 Quebec mass shooting. As you remember, there were about six people who got killed, maybe six, I think, in the mosque in Quebec. So I collected data, a social media post from Twitter, in order to understand what is happening, what kind of trends or issues people discuss. And then while doing the analysis, I found that one of the Twitter users was spreading disinformation regarding the identity of the shooter, claiming that the shooter is a Muslim, and this is all an inside job done by the mosque in order to draw attention to it and probably gain popularity, whatever. It's a complete conspiracy because we know Alexander Bissonnette was involved in the shooting. Now, when I looked at the identity of that user, I was shocked to see that the user has already been covered by other news outlets claiming that he is a member of the Russian state-run trolls. And that was surprising, and I wrote about this in the conversation. So it was just by chance that I was able to find a Russian state-run troll discussing an internal Canadian issue. So that was just by chance. I was not expecting it to be the case. Another example is related to, Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post journalist who was killed by the Saudis in Istanbul inside the consulate. So I was also interested in understanding how, that's for another project. I was interested in understanding how the Arab Spring was discussed on social media. Then I ended up looking at posts that were specifically targeting Jamal Khashoggi. And then specifically looking at certain hashtags and step by step, I was able to see and find and identify a whole hashtag campaign that was launched on the same day Khashoggi disappeared in the consulate. But notice it was just by chance. I was not intending it to be as such. to us just by chance. And from there, I was able to identify other hashtag campaigns that were all launched during the same day. So I made a conclusion that the killing of Khashoggi was a systematic operation, pre-planned and orchestrated by the Saudi-run trolls. And this is the evidence. I found, like, I looked at over probably 35 million tweets in order to reach certain solid conclusions. Mm-hmm. It was not an easy task, but I was only able to do so by chance. I hope I answered your question.
Yeah, I think so. Well, it sounds like this is going to continue to be a problem for quite a while.
For sure. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, this information will continue no matter mm-hmm. what kind of pandemic we have or we don't have. It will become, and it is, an ongoing issue and concern that we need to really be concerned about.
Right.
It's not going away. And, you know, even, you know, the UN mentioned we have today what they called infodemic, an information epidemic, like something like this, or information right. pandemic. It's so widespread that you cannot ignore it. And it's not only limited to Canada, it could be found in every single spot on Earth.
All right. Obviously something we're going to be dealing with for quite some time to come. Thank you for speaking to me today.
Thank you again for having me. Really a pleasure.
Yeah, I've been speaking to Ahmed Al-Rawi, Professor of Communication at SFU, about his research into disinformation and what it means for us all. Thank you for speaking to me today.
Thank you.
SFU Professor of Communication Ahmed Al-Rawi from SFU's Disinformation Project. You can find out more about the Disinformation Project on the SFU website at www.sfu.ca/communication/research/projects/thedisinformationproject.html. And there's hyphens between the disinformation and project. So I'll also post that on our website when I post the program later today. And thanks to Professor Al-Rawi for speaking to me today. Here is Front Burner.
Hi, I'm Jamie Poisson, and in the not-so-distant future.
And this just in, we are back. We can see people again. How about that? I can't believe it. News is on the way. We'll learn more in just a moment. I can't believe it.
There were nights when the wind was so cold.
So I don't know if you've seen this extra gum commercial that went viral last week, but in it, all these people are waking up to that announcement that you just heard, that it's like okay now to actually see people. Some have really shaggy beards, others clearly have not showered in a very long time. But it doesn't matter. They're just dashing out of their dusty apartments, they're storming their offices, they're making out in a park.
If I kiss you like this, and if you whisper like that.
And that's obviously a commercial for gum, so it's not exactly grounded in reality here, but that whole idea of having the freedom to get out there and to not have to worry about COVID sometime in the near future, are we really getting close to that? Could we actually have a real summer? I'm Jamie Poisson, and today, with the vaccine rollout speeding up in Canada, Dr. Lenora Saxinger is here to talk us through all of this. She's an infectious disease specialist with the University of Alberta based in Edmonton. Hi, Dr. Saxinger. Thank you so much for coming on today.
My pleasure. I'm happy to join you.
So we've jokingly been calling this episode the summer one, asking for a friend, but that friend is me, definitely, because I really just desperately want some answers here about what the next few months are going to look like. So we know that on Friday, Canada set a single day record of 400,000 vaccines delivered, shots per 100 people is around 42, give or take, depending on which province you're in. Ontario, for example, though, is on track to administer first doses to 65% of adults by the end of this month. And how do you feel about the progress being made here?
Oh, it's delightful. I mean, it's all been complicated. Every time we think we have a handle on things, we've gotten kind of a curveball or a new angle from COVID. But the vaccine story has really been a remarkable achievement. And the thing that actually is getting me through this current terrible wave three in Alberta is knowing that we're ramping up vaccine availability more broadly, and knowing that that really is, to some extent, our ticket out. Although I'm not sure we're going to have like a necessarily end date or big announcement. I think it's more going to be kind of a fade. But I really think that it's just mm-hmm. we must maintain and protect and augment as much as possible.
I think that's actually exactly the picture I want to try and get from you today, what that fade will look like. First, I did want to mention, though, right now, as everyone knows, we're operating on a 4-month delay for a second dose, but there are some signs that that might be truncated too, right? Which is another positive piece of news on the vaccine rollout, right?
One thing that people have to keep in mind is that, you know, you make a plan based on the best available information at the moment, and it really is supportable to delay the second dose for the majority of people to extend that first dose protection to more people, which will actually protect everybody better. Now, if the supply of vaccine exceeds expectations enough that we can circle back earlier and give that second dose earlier, starting with more vulnerable persons, I think that's fantastic. But no one should think that the current plan is set in stone. I think that we're going to see adjustment as we learn, and adjustment as we kind of get a better handle on our supplies as well.
Right. And as you mentioned, totally in flux right now. But I know that the Globe and Mail is reporting that by the first week of June, enough vaccine doses are expected to arrive in Canada to cover first shots for all eligible Canadians. And then by the end of June, enough vaccine to also cover a second shot for about 17 million people. But for the people that just have one shot right now and are waiting for a second shot, what do we know about how much protection a first dose gives a person? And I guess just continuing on that asking for a friend theme, I got my vaccine on Friday. So, you know, what kind of protection would someone like me have?
Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
So every time someone tells me they've been vaccinated, my heart lifts a tiny bit. It's actually been a very consistent thing, and I'm quite enjoying it. So I think that there's two things to keep in mind about the vaccine first dose protection. One is, like, people can find it very emotional to get their first dose of vaccine, because it really is a very palpable reminder that, okay, this is the end game now. Now I'm building protection. And I've kind of gotten the sense that sometimes people sort of start mm-hmm. behaving protected before they're necessarily protected. So first cautionary note, first downer note from the ID doc is that, you know, just keep doing things the way you've been doing in a defensive and protective way for at least a couple of weeks, because the protection against, you know, hospitalization and death for all of the vaccines is really, really excellent, but it really doesn't start building until after 2 weeks after the first shot. And then from that 2 week after your first dose period forward, you know, there's pretty wide ranging data. And the numbers kind of settle out somewhere between like 70 and 95% protection against symptomatic illness, which is a big range. But it's not just symptomatic COVID. If you're protected and you get COVID and you get a cold instead of a severe illness, then I think that's still a good outcome. So keep in mind the outcomes, and keep in mind that current numbers are going to be subject to change as we learn more. So fixating on one particular number from one study probably isn't going to serve us well. I think it's better to just kind of say, is it a good vaccine or not a good vaccine? How good do we expect it to be? And you are substantially protected from hospitalization and severe outcomes. And then protected from any kind of infection kind of builds over time.
Right, right. Even with one dose.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so for AstraZeneca recipients, there's really good data that the AstraZeneca first dose protection is kind of slower off the mark than the mRNA vaccine. So it starts off protecting well against hospitalization and death, but then the protection from any infection continues to build out to at least 3 months. And so we have really good evidence that that first dose protection doesn't drop at all. In fact, it keeps on going up.
Okay, so given all of that, you know, as people get their first doses And as their friends and their other family members get their first doses, after that sort of couple of week period where it really needs to kick in to build those antibodies, you know, after that period, what advice would you give people who maybe want to have like a small dinner party with six or seven people who have all had their first doses or who want to get together and hang out?
You know, this is an interesting space because I've noticed that most public health authorities have not really come forward with like a firm direction in that regard. And part of it has been because the data on protection after first dose is just kind of coming in now. And no one really wanted to overstep the bounds of what we know. But on the other hand, there's this pressure that people are like, well, why get immunized if I can't do anything differently? Mm-hmm. And I think that I'm somewhat sympathetic to that as well. I think that there's a practical place in the middle, which is, you know, before we've had clear guidance from public health, things that we know reduce risk, like starting from the point that there's no risk situation right now, like there really isn't. And if you're looking at risk reduction, if everyone has had their first dose of vaccine, they're significantly protected against severe illness. You know, if you gather and you still pay attention to some of those, you know, core basics that we know are helpful, like ventilation, like frequent hand washing, like avoiding kind of, if it's a shared meal situation, avoiding shared utensils, uh-huh. You know, outside is better than inside. All of those things would increase your safety in a you know, partially vaccinated scenario. None of it really makes you truly bulletproof. So the other thing to think about is who's at the table. Is there anyone there who would be at risk of not having a strong first dose protection because of a medical condition?
Right.
And so it's the same kind of like fine-tuned thinking about it that's kind of exhausting, honestly, but is kind of necessary. I really do see a good light at the end of the tunnel. I just don't want to jump the gun on saying kind of fly and be free without being able to kind of quantify what the risks might be,
right,
so people can make a decision that's informed, right?
And so speaking of that guidance, you know, I think we're already starting to see a little bit of it. In late April, federal officials suggested that once Canada hits at least 3/4 of the population getting one vaccine dose, it may be possible to start winding down lockdowns over the summer. Theresa Tam, Canada's chief public health officer, noted once she sees 20% of the country that has been fully vaccinated, she thinks officials can also start easing the most stringent restrictions.
These models give us hope, illustrating that there is a safe way to lift most restrictive public health measures, like certain workplace and business closures, by this summer if enough people get vaccinated.
And can you take me through what you think that is actually going to look like? You know, you mentioned before this fade.
I guess one thing is there's the visible stuff. So the visible stuff are like public masking, are like restrictions on businesses and public gathering places. And a lot of that, I think, we have to maintain both because we're wanting some certainty about what the risks are if we drop them. And lots of places have shown us that if you open those things up too quickly before you have good vaccine coverage, that you can get another flare. And so I don't think anyone has the stomach for another flare. So, you know, just kind of being cautious on those things. The other thing is, if not everyone has had an opportunity yet, like a real opportunity to get their vaccine, you know, saying, well, you don't have to bother masking anymore, means that you'll have this mixed situation in public places where some people aren't wearing masks, others are. And looking at them, you don't know whether they're a jerk or whether they've been vaccinated. And that could really create some issues with social cohesion. And I think that kind of like group cohesion is really an important part of a COVID response. And so I would see public masking as being one of the last things to go. I think activities that people, you know, do in gatherings and private spaces are something where, you know, once we can kind of put a little bit of a objective spin on what the risks are, I think that would be something that probably would lighten up more quickly in terms of saying it is okay to do this, you know. Well, and to be honest, I think that's some of the things that people miss the most. And so we have to kind of acknowledge that and honor that people have given up a lot for a long time. And so I would like to see some guidance around, you know, gathering amongst vaccinated persons and how to minimize any potential risk, which I think will be low. And, you know, and at the same time, you're actually not flaunting it in front of people who haven't had a chance for a shot yet.
Right.
So I think that's a nice compromise position to look at.
I want to take you through some scenarios, if you don't mind, and maybe you could tell me how likely you think they are. So Prime Minister Trudeau said last week that he's in talks with other countries about the prospect of vaccine passports. We talked about this on our show on Friday. And he said that if everything goes well with efforts to eradicate the virus, that Canadians could perhaps travel again this summer.
As people start to travel again, perhaps this summer, if everything goes well, it would make sense for us to align with partners around the world on some sort of proof of vaccination or vaccine certification.
What do you think? Do you think that we'll be able to get on a plane and travel this summer, maybe to New York or maybe to the UK?
You know, I think we're going to see kind of a global patchwork of COVID control. And the one thing that everyone has to keep in mind is that although the vaccines are remarkably good, nothing is perfect. I think a lot of the U.S. will actually be in a good position because the places that had really horribly high rates of natural infection, plus now even moderate vaccine rollout, are doing okay. Of course, that came at a high cost. There's going to be a lot of countries that are really still struggling with vaccine access and with ongoing infection. And because it's not impossible to get infected after vaccine, like, I don't think we should oversell that. I think that you would just have to look at where you're going and assess accordingly, mm-hmm. and your reasons for going too. You know, if you had to go to a country that had a lot of uncontrolled COVID, but it was for compelling family reasons. Yes, being vaccinated protects you. Yes, you'd want to make sure if there's boosters needed that you do that and you'd maintain your protective behaviors, but it well could be worth doing. So I think we're going to see a lot more inter-Canadian travel and, you know, some cross-border travel increasing over the summer as well.
And what do you think about the current border controls that the government has? So this mandatory quarantine that you have to do in a hotel if you fly in to Canada, do you think that that will be lifted relatively soon for people who maybe are fully vaccinated?
I think for the fully vaccinated, it would probably be reasonable to lift that fairly early on based on what we know right now. The one other thing that makes this all kind of, it's just such an evolving situation, was if we were aware of a new variant that had a higher rate of breakthrough infections against currently available vaccines, that we might have to replace those restrictions, because then we don't want to reintroduce a new strain into the communities. So far, the vaccines that we have and the variants that we have, it's been a very reassuring picture that we're going to stay okay. And there are going to be boosters developed against the most common circulating mutations that the variants have in common. So it might be a situation where we're going to have to update at some point. But at the moment, it all looks pretty promising. And I do think that that will be able to be dropped once we see enough people vaccinated.
What about children? So now children 12 and up can get the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine.
Health Canada reviewed data from a trial done months ago. It included nearly 2,300 American children aged 12 to 15. Among the kids who received the placebo, there were 18 COVID infections. In the vaccinated group, there were none.
And, you know, I know that a lot of these questions are dependent on the context that you're putting around all of them, but do you think the kids are going to be back in the classroom in September across the country? And if so, what does school actually look like?
I'm feeling very positive about next year being a much more stable year for kids. I mean, kids and youth have had to give up so much over the last while. It's really quite heartbreaking, honestly. They actually have been consistently at quite low risk of getting significant illness from COVID. Experience from Israel, especially because they had this really intense mass vaccination rollout that didn't take that long. It was quite impressive. Showed that as soon as you started vaccinating the adults, the overall disease in the community dropped an awful lot, including in kids. And so even if we don't have, you know, full vaccine coverage of all children and youth by the fall, I really think that as long as, you know, the vaccine rollout kind of stays the way it's been running, that it will be much safer for them, even if we don't have absolutely every single child vaccinated. Okay. We will be getting a lot more data on vaccines. Moderna trial is ongoing. There's quite a number of trials right now for kids. Many of them are from, like, you know, youth age kids, 12 and up. But there's also one starting at age 5-6, and even one starting at 6 month forward. And I think the bar for safety for these vaccines in kids, because the disease is less severe, has to be really, really, really high. And I wouldn't want to rush results. I want to make sure that we can say with a lot of clarity how safe they are. But we know that the kids will be protected by controlling the disease in the community. So I'm feeling very optimistic about school, and I'm kind of excited that it'll feel so much better next year.
you do hear a lot of talk about a fourth wave. I absolutely understand what that looks like if we opened up like tomorrow with still, you know, not 50% of the country vaccinated. Like, of course, you could see how the virus could rip around the community. But you also hear people talk about the possibility of a fourth wave once there is pretty good vaccine coverage. And when they talk about that, what are they talking about? Is it pockets? Is it variants?
I would say that once we've reached a certain amount of you know, population level immunization coverage, that a fourth wave in the kind of sense that we think of these waves is actually very unlikely. Mm. We might see a series of ripples, and that the ripples would be more likely related to areas with lesser vaccine coverage. And so, you know, you might not have the disease disappear from an entire province, but you would have these little hot spots crop up and they wouldn't kind of take hold and they wouldn't spread the way they have been. And so it would be this kind of background flurries, I guess, of COVID in the background. And of course, because nothing is perfect, you would see some vaccine, you know, post-vaccination infections and people exposed to that, which is very much what we see for the other vaccine-preventable diseases. The other thing is, of course, the whole variant story is the thing that's the largest potential curveball in terms of an actual fourth wave. I think that it's likely we'll be able to stay ahead of the variants in terms of sequencing, seeing what's happening. And because the vaccine platforms that we're using are actually really, like, they're brilliant. They're so good. You can actually change the vaccine to adapt to different mutations in the virus spike protein quite quickly. And so I actually think that it's unlikely we would see a big, large kind of pandemic fourth wave related to a variant. I think we'd get ahead of it before that.
I am so buoyed to hear you talk about it becoming this kind of background thing. Wow, that would be a long way from where we've been. One final question before we go, which I have been asking a lot of people. When we do, you know, hopefully, knock on wood, open up more this summer, what are you dying to do once things get back to normal a bit more?
Wow, you know, it's I just really want to be able to go and socialize with family and friends without having that edge of worry. And, you know, travel within Canada to see family and friends is like the top of my list. And just do the things that we've done in summers past and have it feel good. And I think that will be brilliant.
Okay, well, sounds great. I really hope that you get to do that, that we all get to do that. But this conversation is giving me confidence that that is coming. So, Dr. Soxinger, thank you so much.
My pleasure, really. Thank you.
So speaking of the possibility of post-quarantine life, there was this pretty funny sketch from Saturday Night Live on the weekend. It was about just how awkward everything will be once we do get to hang out again. Have a listen.
What's summer even going to be like?
I know, right? Like, will people travel and do stuff?
I will get on a plane with you right now.
Is she my cousin? I feel like I'm flirting with someone that might be my cousin.
So did you travel at all?
No. You?
No.
Is this really a conversation?
I think this is going pretty well.
So that is Elon Musk, you heard at the end there. The Tesla CEO and second richest man in the world hosted SNL on Saturday. And many people predicted he would talk about Dogecoin during his appearance. That's this cryptocurrency that started out as a joke that he's been talking up a lot online. And on Sunday, after Musk called it the future of currency and his hustle on SNL, Dogecoin actually lost more than a third of its price. All right, that's all for today. I'm Jamie Poisson. Thanks so much for listening to Front Burner. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
That's our show for today. Thanks for listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. I've been your host, Magnus Tewald. Please stay tuned for Democracy Now!, coming up next.
Hi, this is Todd from the Blurred Crusade, the best in punk and post-punk.
A big thanks to you and all our listeners for tuning in to CGSF 90.1 FM and for all your continuing support. Without you, none of this would be possible. So join me Wednesdays at high noon and check out all our great programming online anytime at cjsf.ca.